Time to begin. Hello. Hey. There's a scripture that says there's a time for everything. It's now time for us to get Earl up here on the podium and take a look at or spend some time discussing the multi-generational family. That's very important in terms of unity and in terms of fulfilling the scripture that tells the older to pass to the younger. Earl?
Well, as always, it's a blessing to be with you all this morning. I originally wasn't sure I was going to make it today. I had a conflict come up and was able to move it to a little bit later this afternoon, so I will be needing to leave right after worship, but I didn't want to miss the opportunity to talk to you about this really important topic. I feel like I need to begin by explaining this, because several of you have asked me about it. I was going for the distinguished professor look. I don't know how that goes, but actually, I had some students come challenge me at the beginning of November, and they said, if you'll do No Shave November, we'll raise money for cancer research. So I did it in memory of my mother who died of cancer. And at the end of the month, my board of directors voted, and they wanted me to keep it. My board of directors are my grandkids. And, you know, I said, is it because it makes me look distinguished? And they said, no, it looks like cotton candy, and we like it. That wasn't the answer I was going for. But at least so far, and the president of the board, Rebecca, is being patient with me, so we'll see how that goes. She wanted to come today, and she was called yesterday, and there was a woman who teaches a class who was ill, and she's teaching her class for her this morning, so she sends her greetings. This is a topic in which I have a lot of interest, and I do want to recommend, if you're interested in this, probably the expert of all American Christian evangelicals is Holly Allen, who is the wife of Leonard Allen, my dean. Dr. Holly Allen, her specialty is in childhood spiritual development. And she teaches at Lipscomb, has a joint appointment between the Bible and psychology departments, where she teaches class on childhood development, particularly childhood spiritual development. And there's going to be a seminar in June, I believe, on multi-generational teaching. So if any of you are involved in any of that, I would highly recommend that you perhaps think about having a representative there. She brings in experts from all over the world to talk about healthy development of our children's spirituality, and in particular, intergenerational church activities. So when I was first given this opportunity to look at this material, there's so many different ways I could approach this topic. Now we know, and I do want to begin with, let me turn this on, and okay. Your memory verse for this week. And this is not the only verse we could look at. There are many texts that talk about the idea of family. But in particular, this text, don't be harsh or impatient with an older man. Talk to him as you would with your own father, and the younger men as your brothers. Reverently honor an older woman as you would your mother, and the younger woman as your sisters. And so the idea of cultivating a unity across generations is one of the identifying markers of the church. And I'll challenge you more with this during our worship assembly together, but the idea of what this represents for the sake of the world, I'm convinced that today's church suffers a generation problem. And some of the research that we've done, in particular Walter Serdocki, who is our guru on youth ministry, has really been working for the last 10 years at trying to get youth ministers to quit with what he calls the one-eared Mickey Mouse model. It's been called that by others, where you have a youth ministry that's sort of stuck on the side of the church, but it's not really a part of the church. And this has been done since the early 1970s, when it became popular for churches to have youth ministries that separated youth groups from the normal population and sort of had them as a separate group, even introducing things like separate worship for different age groups, etc. And so over 40 and 50 years now, we have the evidence that, for the most part, that's not been helpful to the church. I'm not trying to be critical here. I'm just simply communicating information that is a result of research that's been done on this particular topic. That what it's tended to do is isolate age groups so that it at least diminishes the opportunities for intergenerational activities. There's research that some of you are aware of that recently demonstrated that one of the greatest indicators of whether a young person will maintain their faith when they go through the adolescent years is dependent on the number of adult, meaningful relationships they have with believers outside of their immediate family. So the importance of the kind of intergenerational work that we now have to work at, because the truth is our culture suffers a generational problem. Now, okay, this is a crazy time for me, and you're all busy, I know that, but the first exams were given Friday, and so I'm grading 150 final projects right now. I was grading them yesterday through the day. I even dreamed about grading projects during the night. But it's such a fascinating thing to see, because 140 of those projects are students who have been required to write an essay or some kind of artistic expression to explain what the story of Jesus has meant to them. So this is after 3 months of teaching them the story of Jesus through the Gospel of Luke primarily. Some of them have expressed themselves in artistic works, and I could spend the whole morning just talking to you about those final projects. I will tell you about one young man who everything in his last name ends in an E-U-X. Okay, so he is Cajun to the core. His first name is Bro, actually. I mean, that's his given name. And so he's had a series of, and by the way, he's given me permission to tell his story, so this is not without his permission, but when I first met him, I had him last semester in the Story of Israel, and we got to be good friends, and he came in my office at the beginning of this semester just really struggling with a sense of identity. And as I learned more about Bro and his story, he had suffered at least 5 different major abandonments in his life. And about the second time I met with Bro this semester, he said, "Do you know that you're the first adult male I've ever had a conversation with that went beyond?" But I said, "But you know, okay, I understand. You never knew your dad. He left you when you were an infant." He said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, what about your granddad?" And he says, "Well, he's a very religious man, hellfire and brimstone, and he would preach at me, but he would not listen to me." He said, I think I love my granddad, but I don't know that I've ever had a conversation with him. And so I was able to pair him up with an older man in my Sunday morning class who is actually a certified life coach. And I had a discussion with Bro on Friday that I'll just never forget. I mean, he doesn't even look like the same young man. He looks so different in terms of his life understanding. He went from, at best, agnostic to a fully committed believer in Jesus who now has a dad who's adopted him. And it's just an amazingly redemptive story. And it struck me that he was going to be left to navigate life without the wisdom of generations ahead of him, not by his choice, but by the culture in which we live, where we have tended to isolate people by generations. And I would suggest that's partly because we don't understand each other, and it's pretty uncomfortable. So culture presents an amazingly difficult challenge in bridging generations. And this is going to require work. This is not something where I can just say, you know what you need? You need to have more programs where you get young and old people together, because that's just awkward. There has to be some kind of understanding or structure. And so, I don't know if you've seen, I misspelled Howe here, it should be H-O-W-E, but they wrote a book that's sort of been accepted as a classical identification of generations. You have those, and these are birth years. So if you were born from 1900 to 1924, you're a part of what has been identified officially as the GI generation, also called the Greatest Generation or the Builders. So this is the World War II generation, followed by 1925 to 1945, the Silent Generation. Now, this is interesting because psychologists tell us, and by the way, you'll see this in just a moment, any kind of generational explanation is always going to be generalized, right? So there are always exceptions. So you don't have to be offended by this. I was once in a meeting with George Barna, the great statistician who does this kind of work all the time, and I was bold enough to say, and I was a little bit, I was young, I was a little bit, well, a lot ignorant, but sort of cocky, and I said, hey, what's all this generational stuff? How do you even know if it's true? And his answer was not very pleasant back at me, since he spent his life studying this. But I realize that no one wants to be told how they feel based on when they were born. But when you look at the statistics over generalization, and you look and see how people answer surveys, etc., it's very clear that these generational divides in understanding do exist. And I will tell you, as a teacher, I'm going to talk to you more about this, but as a teacher, as I've adjusted my expectation and requirements of students according to their generational identity, I've become much more effective as a teacher. So here's what I want to challenge you with. You can refuse to learn about the differences in one another because you say everyone else ought to be like me, and I'll talk to you more about that in just a moment. But my question is, to what end are you living? For what purpose are you living? Because if you're trying to make yourself available to the purposes of God, you've got to listen to Paul's encouragement. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, I mean, how clear is this? To the weak, what did he say? I become as if I am weak, although I am not weak. To those under the law, I become as... Okay, so you know the text. I put myself in their place so that by all means I might save them. If your greatest desire is to bring others into a saving relationship with Jesus, you've got to quit complaining about how they feel, how they act, and where they are. They are there for a reason. Most of it's cultural. And for those of you who constantly complain about the young people as they currently act, I got to tell you, it's your fault. It's my fault. We've created the generation that presently exists by not, I'm not saying you personally, right? You don't take this personally. It's that we're trying to figure out how, I mean, what's this whole year been about? By the way, thank you for honoring me enough to let me come and talk to you about these things. I've enjoyed the year with you. I'll look back over this year, and the highlights of the year will be, I told someone this morning that all I do is get in my truck, and it goes, oh yeah, I know where you're going. And here I am, right? But it's been a joy to work through these things with you, because I think you can make a difference. I think you want to learn. You know, you can say, oh, it's a bunch of information. I'm just going to push this away. But here's what I found. I just finished, well, I'll be finishing my last final exam is on Wednesday. Well, the academic year is nice about this. Those of you who have taught it at the college level, you know how nice this is. Every 3 months you flush. Yay, they're all gone and start over. I probably need to come up with a better image, don't I? But anyway, I've had my best semester ever, by far. the kind of discussions I had in my office last week, the kind of final projects that I have been reading. I had a young lady, I teared up yesterday as I was reading through this young lady who said, "It's the strangest thing that I found myself at Lipscomb. When I found out it was a Christian university, I at first said, I'm not going there," but she's an athlete. And she was given a scholarship. Her family had been part of a sort of I talked to about another young lady who was part of an actual sect. And this wasn't quite that bad, but it's a sort of a strange manifestation of a quasi-Christian religion, and her parents had sort of rejected that to the extent that they didn't allow their children to be religious at all. And so she's this good athlete, and she gets a letter from a coach saying, "Would you consider this?" And when she saw it was a Christian school, she marked it off and then realized that Nashville is sort of a cool city, and so she came down to try it out. And here's this one of these young ladies who said, "I got on campus and I thought, this feels right." Feelings. From me, okay? That's my generation there, right? Fuzzy feelings. So I say, "Tell me what that means." She goes, "I don't know. I looked around, saw the beauty of the campus and how people were treating me, and I thought I could study here. And then the field that I wanted to study, you have a really strong school, so I decided to come here." So her essay is she saying, "I didn't know Jesus." And then she told a story. She said, "When I was 10 years old, my mother was diagnosed with cancer, and she was going to die before my next birthday. And I went outside and said, 'I don't think there's a God, but if there is one, would you save my mom?' And she said, I kept walking outside of the house." She said, "I didn't even know why." And she's one of these young ladies who had a diary, so she actually showed me some of her, it was precious, 10-year-old thoughts and how she was praying to a God she did not know. A week later, the cancer had gone into remission. And so here's a young lady who says, I think I have faith in the God of the outdoors. She didn't have a God. So she comes to Lipscomb, and she said, "So we're studying the Gospel of Luke. Now look, this is a new story for me. I'd never heard this one." She goes, "And you know what? I read about Jesus going out and spending the night in prayer, and I said, that's that God. He went outside and prayed to the God that I pray. That's that." She's now a believer in Jesus because Jesus went out and prayed at night. What in the world? Right? But there's something to that that's generational I want to tell you about. That this is the wonder of all of this. So at the end of the day, what I want more than anything else is for you not to be discouraged. Steve Bonner, who is my undergraduate chair, he's got the office right next to me, chairperson. He and I have been doing a series of presentations at educational institutions based on two things. One, delayed adolescence, and then my area is Generation Z. I've actually become a quote-unquote expert in this latest generation in terms of how we have to teach them differently. So I'll tell you that there has been strong reaction against what I present by teachers who refuse to change based on their constituency. Because they say, "Look, I've always taught this way. It's always worked. If our students don't get it, it's their fault." That's the same attitude I find in churches, by the way. It worked for me. Why can't it work for them? If what worked for me doesn't work for them, it's not the church's fault, it's their fault. And I got to tell you, that is not helpful. And it's not even being fair to those with whom you're interacting. So what I'm wanting us to do is, if I had time, and I'd have to have all day for this and more, to go through the differences of each of these generations, but you have the baby boomers, here I am, and many of you. Generation X, these are called the 13ers by some because it's the 13th generation since the founding of our nation. And so sometimes you'll see them designated as 13. Born 1980 to 2000, that's Generation Y. These are also called the Millennials. And it's interesting because we've just made a big shift to accommodate the Millennials, and we don't have them in our classrooms anymore. Because now we got the Generation Zers, and they're unique. They're much different than the millennials. So those of you who teach, you understand what this means is what once was a valid syllabi no longer functions. You have to be constantly adjusting to your constituency, and there's reasons for that. So here's the interesting thing about churches. First time in the history of the world, we have six distinctive generations, and I'm not even talking about grandparents, parents, children. I'm talking about ways of thinking. Now, one of the ways you confront this issue is you do like some churches that I know. You pick out whichever generation's your favorite one, and you say, we're a church for millennials. You're welcome here. And if you're not a millennial, if you get along with us, fine. But if we're not meeting your needs, maybe this isn't your church. But this is not the church I see in the New Testament. In fact, the church I see in the New Testament is the church of difference. That's what I want to talk to you about during worship this morning. And it's one of the things I rejoice about at the Central Family, because you're not the same. Now, that creates some real challenges, but the challenges are worth it because it gives us an opportunity to form a community that shows the world that there's a way we can be one, and that's what I want to challenge you about during worship this morning. So the challenges that we have with education is that each of these generations have different learning styles and different ways of learning. And again, these are always general, so there are exceptions. But Generation Z presents new challenges. One, they are the most depressed generation ever. Part of it is you don't realize how deeply our anxieties affect our children at formative ages, but when Generation Z, remember born around 2000, when they were young, 5, 6, 7 years old, we went through that great recession period. There was a lot of anxiety where all the news was about who knows whether the markets are going to, and you know, you as a parent may not have shown any anxiety, but our nation was deeply anxious. And young people, children in particular, are formed by that general culture. So there are some psychologists that are suggesting that one of the high reasons for the anxiety of our present students, which by the way, I'm telling you right now, we're having to retool everything we're doing as a university because we don't have the capacity to deal with the level of anxiety that our young students have. We have one of the better counseling services of any university I know. But we need to do like what we have times 10 just to work with the young people's anxiety that are currently in our classrooms. Now, it has to do with retention, meaning students are too easily discouraged. And what this means is our students are incredibly fragile. Not all. And again, I'm not trying to indict your children if these are the age of your children. What I'm observing in the classroom, though, especially now giving exams, I've never had to deal with this level of anxiety. And some of these students couldn't get a B if they had to because their average is so high. But they can't imagine not getting an A on their final, even if it means their average grade is an A no matter what. They have this sense that they somehow have to, and I'm saying, hey, tell me what's going on. Why is this so important to you? I just have to succeed. Where are they getting that? And I think part of it is their parents are saying, hey, you got to maintain your grades because you got to maintain your scholarship. And they're thinking back on the insecurity of their childhood and the recession, and there's all kinds of stuff going on there. They don't have any sense of who they are. I'm telling you, I'm observing their behavior. Okay, so this is not an indictment again. I'm not trying to be negative. I'm just saying pay attention. Okay, how about this? They don't even know a world that's not Wi-Fi enabled. There's never been a moment of their life when Wi-Fi didn't exist. Now, what that means as an educator, I can no longer be the information giver. Why? I got it on their phone. Yeah, I was getting out my Encyclopedia Britannica. Anybody even know what that is? We use those once a year because we want our Christmas tree to be about that much higher. And it's always fun to get those out and set them up because our grandkids go, what are those? I says, oh, it's an old form of Google. Right? So this makes a difference. Information is not what they need. And I've got teachers that don't like me because I'm constantly doing these seminars on how we need to adjust our teaching style, because there are teachers who have notes they've used for 10 years or more. They're yellow, and it's not because they use yellow paper. They've taught, and when they first started doing this, they were dynamite, right? Because they were the only ones that knew this. But you can't just give information. I think we as churches need to be aware of that. You know, churches that are built on a strong personality in the pulpit, it means you have to compete against every MP3 download and podcast that there is in the world. You know, there are more people now who are attending church at home than going to assemblies. It's not that they're irreligious. They're just getting what they need through a podcast, unless you're offering them something more. So that's why what we're talking about today is so important. Because church is where you just go to get information. Not anymore. You can get it in too many good places. I know that from some of you. This is one of the most educated churches I work with across the board. I mean, how many of you come up and say, hey, I heard a podcast the other day, or I read this book the other day, and some of you have a reading list longer than mine, and you're reading and you're studying, and that's wonderful. So I'm guessing you're not coming here to hear a itinerant preacher tell you something that you couldn't read on your own. That's the way it used to work, and we're still doing church the same way. I mean, the reason that we preach as we do is because people needed to hear what they themselves could not access. Right? Okay, that's not true anymore. So what are we providing? Now, hey, hear me on this. I actually think church is the answer to everything that we're struggling with if it's appropriate to what God intended for it to be. I think the church is the hope of the world. But it can't simply be the place where you come to get your religious stuff done so that you can get in and get back to your real life. Okay, so it's multiracial, most racially diverse. Before 2050, probably much before, Caucasians will be in the minority in the United States. And I don't think that's a bad thing. But we've got to be able to adjust to it. And now this is the one that we struggle with a lot, because these young people are identity fluid. There's all kinds of reasons. I wish I just had time to talk about this. They are cultural products of decisions made so that the greatest value is individual freedom, expressive individualism. So do you know how you get attention? I have to be really careful here. If you hear this as an indictment, you're not hearing what I'm asking you to think about. Every human being desires to be known. It's the image of God within us. Satan is really good at giving us ways in which we can form identities that get us attention. So I have a young person that I know, and please be careful with how I say this, because I have to really watch my language. But this young person has identified as being transgender. When I talked to them about that, I found out that they got 1,200 likes the first time they identified themselves as such. When I continued to talk to them about sexual implications, they were repulsed by the discussion. Has nothing to do with that. It has to do with identity. And what this means is, we have not given this generation an opportunity to identify themselves, so they're in search of an identity. And what virtual reality has done, or the social media, is it's given them a way of identifying themselves with causes that get attention. And I know this to be true from individuals that I've talked to. There are all kinds of reasons for this. But it's really easy to condemn a generation that can't figure out who they are and not realize it's our fault that they're struggling, because we haven't given them a reason to be who God's called them to be. So one of the things, if Steve Bonner were here to talk to you about delayed adolescence, he would talk to you about multiple selves. That is, that young people, partly because of how we've treated them, again, do I have to say this again? This is not an indictment. It's just observing what the information tells us. Through sports in particular, their parents have taught them that if they play well, they get praised. If they don't play well, they just sort of, okay. And everybody gets a trophy. So we're living in a new kind of culture that bases identity on performance. And what children are learning is what's called transactional relationships, meaning in an environment they find themselves in, they learn how to negotiate that particular environment to their own good. But it's not based on who they are, it's based on who they need to be in that situation. I see this now because I have students who, you know, I think this has probably been true to some extent all along. But what they want to know in my class more than anything else when they first come in is what? Anyone? How do you get an A? Okay, so here's what they'll do. They'll do whatever is necessary to get an A. But they won't remember anything I taught. It's a transaction. They transaction to get, if I don't give them something other than what they're looking for, and I'll explain to you how we do this. They come in looking for information. I can't tell you, I've read through about 120 of these final projects or seen them. And so some of them are written and recorded songs. I had a student from Vietnam who had never heard the story of Jesus before, and he's produced, he's an animation major, so he's produced an animated version of the story of Jesus in Vietnamese. And here's what I love about this. He says, you know, he said, wealthy people in Vietnam don't like religion. They don't need it. And I come from a wealthy family. They sent me here. You know, Tom Bancroft, who is one of Disney's greatest animators, and he teaches at Lipscomb, and that draws a lot of students. And so because Tom Bancroft was at Lipscomb, they sent their son across the ocean to study animation because he was interested in it, and the guy's really gifted. We call him Sam because his actual name is D-U-N-G. That's unfortunate. Okay, no King James people here. So we'll just say, hey, Sam, that's a good name. But here's what Sam does. There's a young man who's, and it's stick figure, but it's really with personality. And he's sort of going like this. And then someone comes up to him and motions towards something, and you can tell the guy's just all full of questions and doubts, and the man walks with him for a little bit, and then after a while, he puts his arm around with him, and then you see both of them coming to life, and at the end, that's who Jesus is for me. He's someone who took me in a moment of confusion and led me to life. I gave him a B. I thought it was pretty... Really? Come on, wake up here. Teaching a new story is going to be the essence of what we have to do with our youth, because the confusion in our culture is not going to help them find themselves. And attending church services on Sunday morning isn't going to do it either. It's going to take more. We've got all this wisdom that we can share about life, and if they're confused about their identity, you know, what I told all my students is, look, you may or may not realize this, but I think you're struggling with these transactional relationships, and it's because you don't have a central identity, which I think we can find in Scripture together. I'm begging you to think about what it means if you see yourself as crafted by God for God's glory, and that you're purpose for learning is so that you might become everything that God created you to be. And we're here to help you with that. And that's why I want to walk with you. I mean, I sort of offered the invitation last week as I brought class to a close and said, we're closing this particular course, but you need to know my concern for your well-being will not end here. I said, as you continue to explore what life might be, there's nothing that would thrill me more than for me to be able to help you find the new life that I think you can only find in Jesus. And that new life is not something external to who you are. It's the essence of who you are, because you were created for this. So, post-Christian. Now, this is interesting to me. They're not anti-Christian. I can't tell you how many students I have in my classroom that have never really heard the story before. like this young lady who met Jesus in the text that says he went out to pray all night. She didn't know the story of Jesus. But when she connected to that experience, then she started listening to what he said. And in that class, you do life labs where you put into practice the teachings of Jesus. And she said, the more and more I copied my life after what Jesus taught, the more I realized he knew me better than I knew myself. Okay, they are anti-institutional. And you can say, yeah, all young people are. And to some extent, they are and have been. Okay, so if you're a hippie or were, right, you had the same issue. But these are a little bit different. And I want to explain why in just a moment. Okay, so what research points out is that every distinct generation has its own influencers. And this is what I'd recommended that you try this, and you may not be able to do it till spring because of the gymnatorium, is that what we call it? Family life, that place that got messed up, all right? It's getting fixed. I really enjoyed, probably my highlight of the year with you, and there have been many, but I really enjoyed the night we sat around tables in different generations and talked to one another. Because I heard some young ladies say some things I wouldn't otherwise heard, learn some stories that I wouldn't have heard. And I told you this for this reason, that I interview all of my students. And I have students, by the way, of every generation. I had a student last year who was in her 70s, and she was a freshman. That was fun. Partly because this is her first time back to school since she gone to a junior college in her youth, and she couldn't believe how different things were. And so I've had students of every generation, and listening to them talk about this, I think it'd be fun to sit around a table, have different generations, and say, tell me who your heroes are. Now, hey, don't critique. Listen and ask why. Core values. Every generation can be identified to particular core values. There's all kinds of questions among psychologists as to whether these are created by culture. Somehow, though, they do get deepened in culture. I'll give you one real quick example. The builder generation, the GI generation, core value, you give of yourself for your nation. You don't even consider the value of your own life, right? Okay, get to Generation Z, it's like, I'm the only thing there is. They've been taught that. But those of you who are veterans, and you're deeply offended why they don't want to join you as a soldier, it doesn't do any good to condemn them for them not responding to feelings that you have that they've never experienced. There's different core values. Are they right or wrong? We need to talk about that. But I'll tell you this. My experience has been that of all those six generations, when I talk to Christian groups and talk about core values, the one that most often comes out is individual freedom, which for a Christian is a problem. Because that's called slavery to self instead of slavery to righteousness. So we live in a culture that affects all of us, and part of what we need to understand is there's no generation that has it right. And if I just offended you, well, good, because I'm leaving town. Attributes. That is, the things that we develop in time. I mean, how about this one? See, some of you old people are going, it's the devil himself, right? Okay, they're just things we develop because of availability and culture, right? Okay, family experience, the normative family experience for my students today, I have less, according to my statistics, less than 30% of my students have what I would consider a normal family. And if I start talking about two generations back, the numbers get smaller. So we expect for certain behaviors to be in other people when they've never had the same experience of family that we've had. I've had to tell some of my students to be careful about presentations they make that assumes that everyone in... I had to pull a group aside that was getting ready to make a presentation before Thanksgiving because they were going to talk about how thankful they were for their families. And I said, no, wait, I've got too many stories in this classroom where students aren't going home to happy families. we need to adjust your presentation so that you're not assuming that everyone has the same experience you have. And the understanding of education, this changes dramatically in terms of what expectations are for what you learn. Why do you learn what you learn? Work ethic, view of work-life balance, values themselves, assets, liabilities, leadership style preference. This one's a struggle. Because there are some of you in here that you want leaders to tell you what to do. That's your understanding of leadership. So you're going to put pressures on the elders of this church to make decisions, usually in accordance with what you believe to be true. Okay. Boy, Generation Z will not respond to directive leadership. Partly because they've been raised by parents many times who want to be their friends instead of their parents. So they've never been given directive leadership, and then we expect them to come to the church and just obey the elders? Good luck with that. And we don't have the kind of relationships that have built the kind of trust that's needed. And so to be a leader, I'm getting ready to teach a doctoral class in the spring on leadership. It's gotten more and more complex because churches have six generational expectations. Each one has a different view of leadership. And each of those generations are going to respond differently to leadership. So you have older generations telling the elders, you need to tell the young people to quit wearing blue jeans to church. I mean, you make the list, right? Or you need to tell the young people that body piercings are the sign of Satan. I've heard that one, right? Well, for you, that might be true. So don't get a nose ring. If you're over 60, that's a bad idea, right? But don't judge those who feel differently than you. I have to tell you, if you would quit being offended by tattoos and start asking for the stories behind them, you might hear some pretty redemptive stories. People aren't intentionally abusing their bodies to offend you. The world is bigger than you, okay? There may be a story there you need to hear. And then vision for life. Each generation has a little bit different idea of the ideal sense of life. And basically, many times it's built off of the failure of previous generations to give what they promise. Okay, so one other thing I need to mention, and I will quickly run out of time. I wish I had more time to talk to you about this. But this one I've mentioned before, but I want to, again, this is another aspect that we need to at least be aware of. I won't spend a whole lot of time here. Charles Taylor is a really excellent, both theologian and sociologist. But he wrote it's a seminal work called The Secular Age, and many people have responded to it in the areas that I do research in. But he talks about how secular first appears at the Renaissance, meaning before the Renaissance, the idea of secular versus sacred, in other words, world, God, that distinction simply didn't exist. The idea is that everything was God's, but then with the discovery of the sciences in the Renaissance, you had a new idea, and that is that you had two different planes in the universe. One was secular, one was spiritual, but you needed both of them because the spiritual taught you how to study the secular or the worldly, so you had sort of other worldly ideas. Secular too, this is post-enlightenment. This is most of us who are 30 years and older. We were raised in secular too, which is basically you have religious and then non-religious spaces. This is a different understanding of secular because the spiritual is no longer necessary. It becomes privatized. In other words, if I want to be a religious person, that's my choice. But in the way that we operate our lives, whether God existed or not, for the most part, wouldn't change much. I mean, if what we do in our lives is not dependent on God, in other words, I grew up in this world. I've lived in this world most of my life without knowing it. But I assigned church to the spiritual realm, but I was told pretty much the rest of my life was up to me. Now, if we don't realize how deeply entrenched we are in that, we can't understand why, we have secular and a religious space. What I mean by that is church, where we are now, is our spiritual responsibility. So we come here because we think we have a spiritual responsibility. And so sacred are institutions and sacred actions, but it's not who we necessarily are all the time. I face this all the time with my students, where they'll say, hey, look, my parents, I think, are religious, but they don't live that way. They've gone to church all their lives, but man, they don't help the poor. You know, they've done these religious things all their life, but I don't see them being generous and forgiving. I have too many stories to tell there. But divine action here is difficult to acknowledge. In other words, you can't talk about the intervention of God because that's sort of strange. Okay, that's the church I grew up in. We couldn't talk about God's activity in our life. God didn't work that way anymore. You went to church hoping to go to heaven when you die. You didn't do any of the big sins, but in terms of waking up every day with a sense that God's going to guide my life into God's purposes, that was not even considered. So secular three, which is where our young people now are, 30 and younger, the negating of transcendence, in other words, there is no spiritual realm. Scientism and secularity have won. And so the whole idea of there being anything that's spiritual, for the most part, a good part of the students that I have coming to Lipscomb now, they're not atheists, they just have never thought about it. It's not necessary anymore. They're what I call apatheists. It's like, so what? It's not even a possibility. So my point is that intergenerational work is going to be, it's essential, but it's extremely challenging. There's nothing easy about it. There's so much wisdom to be gained here. That all have a contribution. You know, I told my students, I said, the reason I interview you each individually is because I learn so much from you. And I do. There are so many things that I know that I would not have otherwise known. Young people's number one complaint about older people is they will not listen to me. Okay, we're all sort of fixers, and we want to be fixers. And you go, this is not fair. I mean, I've had discussions with parents who said, I talk to my young people all the time. What they tell me is they talk to me all the time. There's a difference. Where you ask in order to understand, even if you don't agree, quit trying to fix them and start trying to understand where they are. So I had a young lady, I think I might have told you the story before. I went through, this is a record for me. I think I went through 5 boxes of Kleenexes this semester from students crying and me crying with them sometimes. But I had one particular student who just is such a redemptive story, such a different story. She was struggling with both drugs and alcohol. When she was 5 years old, her mother started letting her smoke weed. Her mother is a concert groupie. All she ever does is goes to concerts. Her dad, she knows, but I don't know that she's ever really lived with him. They're not even divorced. He's a very successful businessman, very well known. He finances whatever she wants to do. She has a credit card that has no limit. So she can do anything, buy anything, and he just says, take care of yourself. Yet she has no relationship with him at all. With his mom, she needs someone to go with her to these, and they go backstage. You know, they're right in the middle of that stuff. And she sat in my office and started talking, and then she started crying, and she said, I don't know why I'm crying. I haven't cried in years. And then she said, oh, I don't, I think I know what it is. You're listening to me. She said, this might be the first time I've ever had an adult listen to me. Everybody has something to share. Everyone needs to be listened to, and that may really be annoying to some of you because some people aren't going to just express it really quickly. But learning to be quiet and listening to their wisdom, there are things to learn. Wonder. Oh, this is hearing the wonder, the activity of God. Hearing the story of a little girl standing outside on a hillside, looking up to the heavens saying, God, if you're there, heal my mom. I mean, okay, you say, no, that wasn't it. It's just they misdiagnosed it. You can think what you want to think. I think God responded to the prayer of a little girl. I choose to believe that God is active as God has ever been. And I hear these stories all the time. There's wonder in the world that we're cheated from when we don't listen to one another. And then godliness. We need to hear one another's stories of how God is working in our lives. And one of the most rewarding experiences of my life as a teacher is seeing students who have been putting into practice the teachings of Jesus all semester, and then they talk to me about what they've learned from those experiences. And these are the stories then that become so operative in my life. So what does it require? First, I'm begging you, if you're going to do intergenerational work, quit trying to fix young people. And young people, quit trying to get your older folks, you got to watch the language here. You know, don't try to make them young, okay? Let them be who they are. Love what they've learned from life, even if you don't agree with them. And if they have a particular view that today's culture would call dinosaur, it doesn't mean it is. It might be true, but we need to learn to listen to one another, right? With respect. And then work through the discomfort. I'm telling you, this is uncomfortable. I can't tell you how long it's taken me to learn to shut up when a young person says something with whom I just totally disagree with. I had a student last year who was Muslim, who on their final project, they decided to do a project that compared Jesus to Muhammad. Oh, I knew that what they wrote was not what was true, and how desperately I wanted to correct it. But I realized the damage that would do, that would put me in a position of power telling them that what they believed was wrong. And that was uncomfortable for me. So I called the student in and I said, hey, I really appreciate the work you did. I think you really captured the teachings of Jesus here and you've lived those out. I'm a little perplexed about how you present some of these other teachings. Can we keep this discussion going? And we've had a really good relationship from that point on. And I believe that God is somehow working through that. It's not mine to make the other person. I know this is tricky, but I'm going to value relationship over winning an argument. And I think the more time I spend in saying, hey, have you thought about this, that I see some real changes in the way that that person is thinking and living now. It takes commitment. So here's things that don't help. Why can't they be satisfied with what they have, right? Why do they have to have something more? Why can't they just accept what I have accepted? Why do they want more? The church gives me all I need as it currently functions. Why can't it be enough for everyone else? They should just submit to our leaders like I have always done. As long as there's a they, you'll never experience the unity that God wants. And so here's a biblical answer. One generation comments or commends your work to another. They tell of your mighty acts. They speak of the glorious splendor of your majesty. And I want to challenge you to recognize that the biblical solution, when the challenge is ahead, people want relationships with one another, but it can't be on our terms. Learning how to listen, seek to understand before attempting to be understood. Remember, people believe what they believe because they believe it. That's an important idea. We'll come back to that during the sermon. We must respect one another, love one another, build up one another, and do all for the love of God. And my hope is this is a wonderful family. But if we can cultivate even a deeper awareness of our need for one another, let's not disdain one another for ideas with which we disagree. Those of us who are older, we can't judge young people based on our experience of life because they're living in a different world. So when you have questions, instead of condemning, ask the questions and then listen and seek to understand so that even if you don't disagree or agree, it builds a relationship that will allow a student to recognize that you have a concern or a child or you know whoever, we have concern for one another. Now, what I didn't want to do this morning is leave the idea that the problem is with old and young. It's all of us at every step. Because we all have different ideas. We have different political ideas. We have different teams that we cheer for. There's differences among us, right? What really matters? What makes us one? What makes us family? That's what we'll talk about during our worship this morning. Let's pray together. Loving God, thank you for the Central family. Thank you for all the work that's been done to help us look deeply into your design for the church. But Father, help us also recognize that we desperately need to hear one another, spend time with one another, love one another across all generations, that what the world desperately needs is a community of people who love as you love. But the world's not going to know that if we don't love one another first. So may we seek the kind of unity where everyone has a voice, everyone is appreciated for what they believe, and that there's loving wisdom and the wonder of your work among us, all to your glory. We pray this through Jesus. Amen. Okay. Thank you.